From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. For a second time, the U.S. Supreme Court has refused Republican efforts to block a three-day extension to count absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. The court made a similar decision for North Carolina, extending the deadline to 9 days after Election Day. The justices did signal they could revisit the Pennsylvania case after the election.
And Pennsylvania is a critical state for both President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Polling averages show Biden leading by roughly 4 to 6 percentage points. For the latest on what's happening there, let's bring in Jonathan Lai, data and democracy reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, what does this SCOTUS ruling mean for voters, especially since Justice Alito has said it could be reopened at another time?
That's right. I mean, the reality is, you know, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave us a three-day deadline to get our mail ballots in, but we don't know whether that's going to stand. So right now, yes, you know, people can rely on that extension. They can get those votes in after Election Day, but we don't know whether or not those will actually end up being thrown out. The Supreme Court could rule after Election Day.
This is hugely consequential.
It really is. I mean, we just don't know how many voters, you know, they'll mail their ballots in maybe Monday or even Tuesday on Election Day, and those ballots won't come in until maybe Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. And if the court goes one way, those votes will get counted. If the court goes another, they'll be thrown out.
What are county election officials being advised to do because of this?
So you don't want to start counting those votes and mixing them in with all the rest, because then there's no way to deal with them later. So what all the counties are being told right now, to separate any ballots that come in after Election Day, so that whatever the court decides to do, whether to count them or to reject them, they'll be able to deal with them and not be mixed in with all the rest.
This is the first year in Pennsylvania that any registered voters can vote by mail. And this Tuesday was the deadline for people to apply for an absentee ballot. And we saw these huge lines of people waiting for these ballots. How much can you tell us about the demand, and can you break down how this system works?
So before this year, we actually had a really restrictive absentee voting system. Very few people could vote by mail. And so actually in past elections, only about 5% of votes were ever cast by mail. This year, especially with the pandemic and with a new law that allows anybody to vote by mail, we've had huge demand. In the primary election, for example, just over half the votes were cast by mail. So we went from 5% to 50% in a single election. And so what we're seeing in this particular election now is a lot of people are trying to vote by mail. We might have as many as 3 million votes cast by mail.
You actually worked with ProPublica recently to examine data on what communities were registering for mail-in voting, and found that lower-income communities were less likely to register in Philadelphia, which also happens to be one of America's poorest cities. What exactly is happening and why?
That's right. I mean, Philly is the poorest big city in America. And so with something like vote by mail, what you see is it's really becoming something that is more accessible, more convenient, more flexible, but it's not necessarily helping poor and low-income Philadelphians. So what we see, for example, is that when you look at who's requesting to vote by mail in this election, we looked last week, and in the 10 highest income zip codes, the richest Philadelphians, nearly half of them, 47%, were requesting to vote by mail. But in the poorest 10 zip codes in Philadelphia, only 27% were trying to vote by mail. So there's a big gap between who's actually interested or has access or is willing to vote by mail.
I want to ask you about something else. So earlier this month, the Trump campaign filmed voters dropping off their ballots in a supposed attempt to count how many ballots people were dropping off. Some of these tactics themselves have been called voter intimidation. What are you seeing on the ground, and what do voters need to know?
So it's a little bit hard to say exactly what's happening. You know, there's a lot of noise out there, a lot of campaigns or people affiliated with them doing a lot of different things. Here's the key that every voter needs to know. Voter intimidation, in whatever form, is illegal. And there's not some magic switch that says something is voter intimidation or it's not, right? If it were that simple, we wouldn't need courts. We wouldn't need the justice system. But it is true. Voter intimidation is illegal, And if somebody feels like somebody is trying to intimidate them, trying to coerce their vote, trying to deter them from voting, trying to force them to vote in a specific way or to not vote, they should go and talk to law enforcement. They should talk to their county, their state, even federal law enforcement officials, and let them know that they believe somebody is interfering with their voting rights.
What can we expect in terms of results that night, especially in light of this new Supreme Court ruling?
Well, we can certainly expect it to be a lot messier than what we've seen in the past. You know, I think a lot of us are used to sort of staying up on election day. You get the big banners on the TV screens and they tell you who won. You're not allowed in Pennsylvania to start opening and counting these mail-in ballots until 7 a.m. on election day. And remember how I said there are going to be 3 million of them? That takes a long time to count. It's not going to be done by election night.
That's Jonathan Lai, data and democracy reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And let's stay for a moment in Philadelphia, a Democratic stronghold where 40% of registered voters are Black. Turnout among Black voters has fallen recently, so this year there's an effort to boost enthusiasm. Here and now, Chico Theuri went to Philadelphia's City Hall this week, where people stood in a long line to vote early or drop off ballots. Chico met several Black Democrats who support Joe Biden, starting with Lorena Bird, a state employee from West Philly.
I voted for Biden because I feel we need a change. And I really, this is just my opinion, we need to clean the whole Senate and the Congress House out and start again. Because some of them, no. You have too many people, thank God I'm not one of them, but too many people that are waiting for their stimulus or who are waiting for the unemployment to increase just to make ends meet. And it's not right that you did the campaign, you did this Supreme Justice before looking for the people. But we are the people, and we are the ones that put you in office. We are the ones that take you out of office. And I think being in politics, some of the, it's a business. We need to clean house completely. Just clean it. All of them. I voted my mail-in ballot. I didn't do it through the U.S. mail because it's not getting there. And you do have some people going around various cities that's burning the ballot boxes. I'm concerned. Just because I don't believe or see things your way, just respect me for that. You ain't got to like it. Just respect it. And we lost that. And if we lost it, how are we to teach our children that?
Mark Walker, from Philly, King of Prussia area. I'm 27 and I do music. Honestly, I don't have any faith in America at all. They never really cared about Black people. We've been fighting the same fight forever. But all I can ever hope for is that someone cares. Care enough to see that we are just persecuted from everyone. So I just want somebody to care.
My name is Cheryl Coulter. I'm retired. I'm 60. And I'm just standing in line, for my voting right. I just don't want people to be deterred. Mm-hmm. And to wait is a small thing when you have to deal with what we're dealing with today. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do my part to wait. If that's what it takes, then that's what we'll do.
My name is Joshua Price. I'm from South Philly, and I'm currently on disability. And I'm voting for Harris and Biden because of my disability, my health care, the economy, and how Trump treat Black people like they the gum under his shoe. All Trump's trying to do is take people's health care away from them. And I got a condition, so that puts me in that category just like everybody else.
My name is Kelly Williams, and I'm from West Oak Lane, so Philadelphia born and raised. I believe Biden and Harris, they need to understand the relationships with the police and with Black folks. I was so sad and I couldn't even watch the video. I don't know the circumstances involved, but I heard a young African-American male was killed in West Philadelphia in front of his mother, you know, and that's been happening far too often. If this issue is not addressed and healed, unfortunately, people are going to continue to protest. They're going to be in the streets. It's going to be havoc. We need to heal what's going on with the Black community. I think that is a very crucial, you know, issue.
Larry Mattis, I'm from North Philly, and 65. And, I just got up this morning. I got up here early enough before this. But the only problem I see right now is that we're standing in line so long. It's kind of frustrating, but it's worth it. Let's just put it this way. It's time for a change. You know, you think about the fact of being, well, in my case, 65 years old, and this is the worst I've seen in anything. It's just ridiculous. It's frustrating. It's upsetting. And it's time for something different. So, and I believe my candidate's going to be the one to do it, both of them. But I don't think it's going to be a very smooth transition. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of court battles. I think there's going to be a lot of back and forth. But we'll see what happens. Anybody out there who hasn't voted, now's the time to do it. Y'all need to wake up.
Voices of Black Democratic voters in Philadelphia in the crucial state of Pennsylvania.
So tell me, are you trying to live to be the Oberon? Does it even matter who wins?
Singer-songwriter William Prince has had a busy year even with the pandemic. He's released not one, but two albums. This is from Reliever, which Prince released back in February.
Now you're Reliever.
And then just last week, there was Gospel First Nation. Here's the album's title song.
Up there on Gospel First Nation, the highway feels like salvation. In days of childhood, wondered how I would wind up where I am today. Just need to see it for yourself. Does something for your health if we left right now, I could show you. I swear Jesus just might live alone with all our sins in Fisher Bay, Manitoba.
Gospel First Nation explores the complicated relationship between Christianity and Indigenous people in Canada. William Prince joins me now. Welcome.
Oh, what a pleasure, Peter. Nice to speak with you.
Sure. And let's talk about that song. I looked up Fisher Bay, Manitoba, because I had never heard of it before. Population 45. Is that the same place you're singing about?
It is. I think it's technically a place if you look it up on Wikipedia. It's not even a town. It's a place. A very special place.
Yeah, tell me about it. What was it like to grow up there?
I grew up just south of Fisher Bay on the reserve. Peguis First Nation. To get to Fisher Bay, you drive through Peguis First Nation, then you drive through Fisher River Cree Nation, and it eventually leads you to the end of the highway, which is this beautiful kind of spot to sit and look out over the vast Lake Winnipeg, this beautiful body of water, and there's a tree line way in the distance, and it's just beautiful, serene sky and water.
Well, the title of your new album, Gospel First Nation, seems to refer to the two sides of your very interesting identity, one as a Native person and the other as a Christian. What does Gospel First Nation mean to you?
Gospel First Nation is a delicate blend of two very important realms in my life. I have heritage that links back to Chief Peguis, the founder of the Peguis First Nation Reserve in Manitoba. And my grandfathers, Albert Prince and Edward Prince Sr., the men my dad would have grown up around, they were the founding pastors of the Prince Memorial Chapel. That's a church that's been standing there since 1929 on the Peguis Reserve. And, you know, so just as much the grandson of a great chief as I am a great preacher. And there's a interesting conversation around Christianity and gospel music because these were the tools of the oppressor, so to say, to colonize and assimilate and ultimately extinguish First Nations Indian identity in Canada. So I try to extract the joy from it, and the album is around the nostalgia of playing songs, learning music through these old hymns and choruses with my dad playing for different communities.
Well, in fact, your dad wrote one of the songs on your album. This is called This One I Know.
As I walk through this world and its trials, I was weak from the sin and distress. There I was in total denial. As I searched
for that heaven of rest.
You've already said this very well, that Native people have had a complicated relationship with Christianity in North America because, of course, it was used to assimilate indigenous people into Western culture. So tell me more about that, William. How have you grappled with that conflict?
I was very much inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement, where so many people at the hands of a racist North American justice system are being mistreated generation after generation. And when declaring my solidarity with these folks as a First Nations person, because in Canada, we're quick to say, at least we're not as bad in terms of racial relations as the United States, when the truth is the nationalism of great Canadian pride, this gathering place of many cultures and accepting nature and politeness and hockey and, you know, great spirit. Just beneath the floorboards is the history and rightful entitlement to the land by the First Nations people, who are now mistreated and cast out so that there can be this development of pipelines and industry without consent, mm-hmm. without any respectful dialogue with them. And these are members of my family who are affected by the generational trauma inflicted by the church.
So when those members of your family and your neighbors and other members of First Nations in Canada, like, hear your music and they see how far it's getting you, like, how do they respond? Is there any resentment that you've embraced this side of your identity?
No, because this is a common tale. The truth is, there were a lot of First Nations people raised in the church who have similar memories of fellowship and community. And I've seen these songs lift spirits in the darkest, bleakest places. Some First Nations communities where suicide is an ongoing epidemic, the effects of, you know, sexual abuse, alcoholism, substance abuse inflicted by a government. And so it is a delicate thing to sing about. I understand that. And you can put some rationality to it as long as you want, but the truth is, it's just coming from a place of honesty where I shared these songs with my family, and I wanted to kind of capture this sound.
Yeah. Well, let's stay with that theme of alcoholism, substance abuse. Here's a song called Higher Power. It's written by Bob Norman, a First Nations man from the Meadow Lakes region of Saskatchewan.
Yes, there's a higher power, and now I know his name. When I called on Jesus, into my life he came. He took away my cravings, and he washed away my sins. He changed this alcoholic into a child of a king.
Every good country artist has a song about drinking. They don't often invoke God in the same song. And then gospel music doesn't often invoke drinking at all, which is what makes this song so interesting to me. Tell me about this issue, though, of alcoholism. Is this something that you've struggled with in your own life or that you've seen firsthand?
My dad was an alcoholic, and he thankfully got a hold of it as he met my mom and changed his life and was a speaker for AA for many years. Of course, AA has its connections to spirituality, so it's and it runs prevalent in the First Nations community. There's a lot of turmoil because of addiction to alcohol, and it's stemming far back. Alcohol was brought over by the colonizers, the settlers, and a dependency was formed on it. And today, you know, my spirituality, I wouldn't define myself as Christian anymore. I very much believe in the universe, and I'm a scientist as much as I am a believer. I can thank and declare, you know, thank you, Lord, for this day. Thank you for opportunity, choice, privilege, safety. You can have this dialogue of gratitude that ultimately will attract better things in your life, I believe. I owe all of this. This very conversation we're having about another record is because of a continued campaign of giving thanks for where I get to be and how I get to live my life.
Well, in fact, this is the second record you've released in 2020. So let's take a moment just to talk about the first one. Here's a track from Reliever, which was released earlier this year. It's called The Spark.
When the ashes of lost love make it hard to breathe,
my love, if we burn, would you burn right next to me?
Country music doesn't really have a reputation for being diverse. I just wonder if you've had any hurdles to clear as your career advances because of who you are.
I'm not obstructed by any hurdle. As a First Nations person, I'm used to having to work 25% harder for the equal amount of respect anyway. So I very much believe in, if you're good at something, you'll tell everybody, and if you're great, they'll let you know, you know? And so I've let the songs speak for themselves. That's all I've ever wanted, to be judged solely on my art and the merit of that art.
Well, plus your voice, that baritone, how could people do anything but embrace it? I mean, just tell me about your voice. Has it always felt so powerful to you as it sounds now?
Not at all. It was something I fought for a while. I had young person ambitions of being in a alt-rock band, and you had to be a bit of a wailer. I think of like the Miles Kennedys of the world and the great singers, you know, Robert Plant and such. And it's like, that's not who I am. That's not how I produce sound and use. Once you unlock the idea that your voice is an instrument, it blends itself to a whole new category of uniqueness. Think of the great voices, Tom Petty and, you know, Neil Young, and the great Bob Dylan. And these voices evolve and do wonderful things over time, and I hope that I can lend myself to that too.
William Prince, the new album is Gospel First Nation. Thank you so much. It was a joy to listen to it.
Thank you, Peter.
Jesus is my plea. Daily walking close to thee, let it be.
Resort areas are having a moment as residents from more urban, pandemic-stricken regions search for more open spaces. In remote Western Maine, many of those newcomers are settling down permanently, bringing economic activity and challenges. Maine's Public Radio's Fred Bever reports.
It's been a heck of a season at the Lakeside Convenience and Marina, where vacationers can grab sandwiches and rent a boat for a 10-mile ride around deep blue Rangeley Lake.
We went from, you know, worrying about bankruptcy to having, honestly, the best summer we've ever had in 10 years. Who'd have thought? We certainly didn't.
Co-owner Lynn Noyes says in the pandemic's early days, she and husband Paul had to overcome their wariness of out-of-towners who might bring the COVID-19 virus with them. By late spring, though, a lot of tourists were being welcomed here, and now some of those visitors are putting down new roots. That's thanks in part to the way the pandemic opened up new frontiers for remote work.
I think I've heard we've had like 26 new kids in our school, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you have to understand we have 150 K-12 usually. So when you have another 26 kids, that's kind of a lot. I mean, everybody's throwing a sign up on their house.
Everything's
for sale.
Stuff that's been sitting for sale for 5-10 years, gone in a week.
The median price for a home in this county rose nearly 30% this summer to $194,000. Statewide, the number of out-of-state buyers rose as well to 1 in 3.
The pandemic, quite honestly, has really helped us.
Realtor Jamie Eastlack says that in a typical year, about 20% of showings end with a quick sale. This year, he says, it's been more like 80%.
These are people that are new to the area and just jumping in and purchasing property. Just to get to an area that is like this, you know, there's just not a lot of people around. It's beautiful, deep lakes, ski mountain.
Eastlack says there is concern about pressure on the school system and affordable housing. Recently, he was preparing one home for sale to a Rhode Islander, which could displace the local family that was renting it. New dynamics are playing out elsewhere in the area, including at Sugarloaf Mountain, a ski resort about 40 minutes away.
I met one couple who came. They live in a high-rise in Boston, and they have a place on the mountain. And they came up in March to ski, and they never left.
Ben Willauer is a consultant from Freeport in southern Maine. This year, he and his wife moved to the Sugarloaf area, joining an emigration from urban to more rural outposts that's being seen elsewhere in the country, and they are enrolling their two young children in the local school system.
We felt it was an ideal time for us to get to know that community more on a full-time basis, and in the meantime, we then put our house up for rent for the school year down in Freeport, and quickly found folks from the mid-Atlantic states who were eager to come to Maine as an alternative to where they were in Maryland.
Massachusetts resident Kim Denny, her husband and 82-year-old mother set out recently for a hike toward the 4,100-foot peak of Saddleback Mountain. Most summers, she says, far-flung relations visit their Maine vacation home only sporadically. This year, the extended family gathered here, quarantined, and really settled in.
Because there's a lot of space up here. It's pretty easy to be socially distant, even as we're standing in the parking lot together ready to hike the mountain.
Downey says she's excited about the region's future, but she adds,
be careful in how much you promote, because it's kind of beautiful, and we like that socially distant.
For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever.
Election officials across the country are receiving suspicious emails that appear to be aimed at undermining the presidential election. It comes as President Trump has questioned the security of mail-in voting without evidence, and as U.S. intelligence officials have warned that Russia and Iran are trying to interfere in this year's election. Joining us now is Michigan's first-ever full-time elections security specialist, Ashia Brown. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate it.
And tell me more about these suspicious emails. Have you seen them in Michigan?
Absolutely. We have seen them in Michigan. They're actually becoming more and more common as we approach the actual election day. There are emails coming in to our election officials, our clerks mainly, looking to grab information. So they're like malicious links. So that has been one of our main concerns that we've been handling.
Well, does that mean that they're trying to get the workers, the elections officials, to click on these links so that they can then get access into the election systems?
What it seems like from our investigations, what we've got information back, we have a couple of federal partners that are looking into it for us, and they give us results back. So what we have found out that a lot of it are phishing attempts. So they want the workers to, in fact, click the link, but also the attempt to try to take over that election worker's account. So by gaining access from the worker clicking the malicious link to give them the ability to then send emails from that election official's accounts to mask as if it was that official sending those emails. Those are the most common ones that we've seen, and those are the ones that we've kind of been shooting down immediately and that we've trained our clerks on noticing as soon as they come in what to do with it, and we send it to our investigation team to track those.
Do you know who's sending them or where they're coming from?
We do. We do investigation down to the point of the IP address. Some of the IP addresses have come from overseas, but most of them are from here, and we are still currently investigating those. Even warrants as we speak today are being drawn up to get more information on a couple of those. So we do see them locally and domestically.
Oh, that's interesting. It's both domestic and foreign. On the issue of foreign interference, your boss, the Michigan Secretary of State, has said that she doesn't think Michigan's election systems were compromised by Russian hackers in 2016. But of course, last year, the Senate Intelligence Committee said that Russians targeted election systems in all 50 states. Do you have any evidence that your systems are being tampered with this year?
Not at all. This year is a little different. Like you said, I'm the first election security specialist that they have had. So actually, as of last year, we put together an amazing task force with federal and state partners to work together. And then we're also lucky that in Michigan, we have three election voting systems. So it's a bit harder to tack down and hone in on trying to like hack or access our systems because they are three different ones and they're all three.
And what do you mean by that? One is digital, one is paper, something like that?
No, they're just hosted by three separate companies, Hart, ESS, ESNS, and Dominion. They're just three companies that provide our voting system rather than someone being able to attack Michigan with one set of like attackers using a set of instructions that they've created because of the system we use is much harder in Michigan because we do have three separate systems.
I see. So you do sound confident in the security of this election, but where do you think you're most vulnerable?
there are areas that I am concerned, and I feel like the public is concerned as well. And that comes into misinformation and physical security on election day, just making sure that Michigan's constituents are confident and feel safe going to their voting location. As you know, in the recent days, there was a ban on firearms, which was later overturned by the Michigan Court of Claims judge. So that opened up a whole nother window with firearms being banned, and then now they're not banned. So just making sure that our voters feel confident and safe and know that we're doing everything possible. And we understand that there's misinformation coming. There are robocalls individuals are receiving. So another big thing that we are focusing on is misinformation and making sure that we correct it and get the correct information out immediately to our public to get voter confidence.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the issue with the guns at the polls and physical security, because it's not just that. It's also, as you well know, that members of a militia in your state have been charged with trying to kidnap your governor, Gretchen Whitmer, because they didn't like her politics. What are you doing to make sure that people feel safe when they go to the polls?
Sure. So the Michigan Sheriff's Association, they are doing a big part of this as well. They have sheriffs across the state. We have the Michigan State Police Intelligent Operations Center, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, the Attorney General's Office, as well as the National Guard. And we work and we meet daily at this point. So we're able to deploy people in a great manner in a great amount of time.
Ashia Brown, Michigan's full-time elections security specialist, the first one ever in that state. I know it's a very busy time of year for you, so thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on another key state in this election, Florida. President Trump is holding a rally in Tampa today, and Democratic candidate Joe Biden heads there later. But first, he's in Broward County in South Florida. Both candidates are trying to energize voters in this crucial state in the final days of the campaign. Let's check in now with Katie Swatalski-Munoz, who is following the race. She's a reporter at WLRN, and she's in Fort Lauderdale. And Katie, first, Florida is home to the president, his resort, Mar-a-Lago, and he says it's his adopted home state, and he won it by just 1.2 percentage points in 2016. He likely needs to carry Florida to win again. What do the campaigns have planned today?
The president has a Make America Great Again rally at the Tampa Bay Bucks Raymond James Stadium. And it looks like he and Joe Biden will have dueling rallies today in the same spot, because after Joe Biden is here near Fort Lauderdale, he is going to Tampa to also have a rally over there. They'll be in the same spot for a few hours.
Polls show a tight race, but Biden is benefiting from this ad blitz by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's spending $100 million on ads in Florida through his super PAC Independence USA. And former President Barack Obama campaigned for Biden in Florida twice earlier this week. He held events in Orlando and North Miami. What is the overall state of the race in Florida right now?
As I think a lot of people watching Florida expect, it's tight. It's tense. You have a lot of people here mobilizing and moving for Biden and the Democrats. You have a lot of people who are mobilizing for the Republicans and Trump 2020 billboards, even in a place that is such a Democratic stronghold for the state of Florida, like South Florida and Broward County. Florida is absolutely famous for its razor-thin margins on election night. And I think that the candidates are recognizing a lot of people have already voted. We have more than 7 million people that have voted by mail and have voted early combined now. So that's more than half of the state's registered voters. Yeah. And we're still days away from election day.
What is the state actually doing to prepare for this surge in absentee ballots? That's quite significant.
I think Florida is actually better positioned than a lot of states, because we had quite the recount and issues with counting ballots back in 2018. That was our gubernatorial election, and there were several statewide recounts. This time around, Florida has actually changed the laws. So we've been counting vote-by-mail ballots already ahead of time. In comparison to states that can't do that until election day, like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. So we've already been counting. We're allowed to start counting vote-by-mail ballots 22 days before election day. That could put Florida in a good position to finish a count earlier than other states. One thing that has caused some concern as we have early voting here is it's been quite rainy here, but it hasn't seemed to dampen the turnout.
Mm. Florida voters are deciding on more than just the presidential race. There are also several competitive House seats and six potential amendments to the state constitution up for vote. Just briefly, what else are you watching for with just a few days left in this election season?
Yeah, we do. I would say we're certainly watching the six state constitutional amendments you mentioned. There's one that would open up. Right now, Florida has a closed primary system. So if you are not registered with a political party, you cannot participate in the primaries. One of our amendments now here in this general election would be to open up that primary system. And there's also an amendment, a proposed amendment to raise the minimum wage in the state up to $15 an hour. There's a lot that Floridians are voting on that's not just the president in this election day.
That's Katie Switalski-Munoz, reporter at WLRN. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The pandemic has a lot of us doing more in the kitchen and maybe trying to get our kids more involved as well. But we're already over 7 months in, and your go-to recipes may be getting a little stale and your kids a little bored with your take on mac and cheese. Let's find some kid-friendly inspiration from our resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Kathy, great to speak with you again.
Hello, Peter.
Hi there. And you know, this pandemic has actually been pretty good for my older kids' baking skills, which is great, you know, but I've been trying to get her to move beyond the endless batches of cookies and brownies that she's making. Where should I start? How should I do that?
Well, you're not alone, and nor is she alone. I've baked my way through the past 7 months. The great thing about inviting your kids into the kitchen is that there is so much to be gained. There are the obvious pitfalls, like you can get lunch and dinner on the table a lot quicker without them, and your kitchen will presumably be cleaner. But start with something that really excites them. Let them choose. Maybe you throw a bunch of fruit and ice cubes and yogurt out and say, let's all make our own smoothies. Everybody gets to make their own, and they get to do it exactly the way they want. Or maybe they want to smash some avocados into guacamole, and you add the last tomatoes and a little bit of lime juice, or something even as simple as popping popcorn, and then they can choose the toppings. You want to engage them and empower them. The whole point is to say, we're going to learn together, and there is so much to be learned when you bring your child into the kitchen.
And it sounds like you're saying you can take baby steps with that. So let's talk about some of the recipes that you have, starting with pancakes, which are kind of like the cookies and the brownies that my daughter's been baking.
Kind of, but these are maple banana pancakes, and they've got several things going for them. Number one is you can make the batter the night before, because the idea of making pancakes from scratch on a work day and a school day can be overwhelming.
Yeah,
so you make this very simple batter. Yeah, exactly. But it's really stirring and measuring, and there's buttermilk in this, and there's whole wheat flour and regular flour. Cooking with kids is a great time to teach STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math. You know, how much is one cup? What's a half a cup? What's half of a half a cup? You're constantly cooking and playing with this food and creating things, but there's teaching lessons. And then what you do is you take bananas and cut them into slices, saute them very quickly with cinnamon and ginger or whatever your favorite spices are, drizzle a little maple syrup over them so they get all gooey, and then you put those on top of your pancakes before you flip them. It's very, kids really, really get into making pancakes.
You know, you mentioned buttermilk. I'm glad you did. The other day I needed buttermilk. I didn't have it. And my daughter said, I know how to make buttermilk. You just add some lemon juice to milk. And I was like, what? She was right. And that's amazing.
You've got You've got a genius in the house.
All right. I know you brought a recipe for, you brought a recipe for quesadillas as well. Always fun with the kids.
Yeah, this is very simple, and essentially you can think of this like a grilled cheese meets a taco. Let the kids shred the cheese, careful of their fingers. You can open a jar of salsa, you can make your own salsa, and then this is where the fun comes in. Oh, we have that leftover chicken from dinner last night, or those roasted veggies would be good on this. Oh, let's add some beans. So again, they're adapting the recipe, they're customizing it, and all you're really doing is heating up a tortilla putting the shredded cheese on until it's bubbling, and then you can top it with the salsa and sour cream or yogurt or radishes or anything you have on hand.
That's smart and doable. It sounds doable. This next one that you brought does seem a little bit more complicated. Tell us about this one, a pumpkin coconut soup.
Yeah, making soup sounds a little sophisticated and complex for cooking with kids, but it's not. The orange color and the sweet pumpkin flavor and the coconut is going to win them over. First of all, kids love pushing buttons, and this mostly happens in a blender. You saute an onion, you add peeled, chopped up pumpkin or winter squash, or open a can of pureed pumpkin. Add a little salt and pepper, some vegetable stock or chicken stock. Let it cook. Throw in a can of unsweetened coconut milk. And then the fun. You slowly put it in the blender. Don't overfill it or we have a disaster. And you whirl it up. And it's kind of a soup that happens in less than 30 minutes.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of time. You did talk briefly about safety. And, you know, on a job like this, you said you could use the canned pumpkin or a real pumpkin. Is cutting up the pumpkin a job for the adult or the kids? Or what do you think about that?
Cutting up the pumpkin is definitely a job for an adult supervision. Whenever you have knives or sharp objects out with kids, you always want to sort of be holding their hands so that you're both using the knife. You can also buy pre-peeled chunks of squash and pumpkin now. Also, wear an apron, less laundry later. If you have really young kids, you could put a mat out under the floor. But just remember that you're building memories, you're creating rituals, you're creating traditions, and it's been proven the kids that cook eat more fruits and vegetables.
Oh, really? You know, my little one always wants to stir the pot, which makes me anxious in more ways than one. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have all the recipes at hereandnow.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
What is it that makes scary music scary? We'll explore the music that's been spooking people since the Middle Ages next time on Here and Now.